there were like these values that were being sort of represented in that original bottle that maybe had been lost. So actually, more than anything, we did want it to be this sort of North Star that, you know, you hold the work up to. Legacy is history with a future. And I guess when you work on these brands that have a history, you always want to like dip into, you know, any latent equities they have or typefaces or colors or sort of things that had existed in their past that you can potentially like use and bring into the future.
Hey everyone, welcome to A Change of Brand, a show featuring behind-the-scenes stories of rebrand glory, drama, or disaster. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, I'd like to make a toast. A cheers to a legacy brand striving to become more iconic and relevant to a new generation. A toast to Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark is a bourbon brand that has been around since the 60s and is reasonably priced and easy drinking. Bourbon is a type of whiskey, an American whiskey, actually, distilled from a mixture made primarily of corn. Whiskey, which is the umbrella term for the entire category, is a spirit made out of fermented grain, most often rye, wheat, corn, or barley. There are 9 types of whiskey in all, and bourbon is just one. For whiskey to call itself a bourbon, its mash, the mixture of grains from which the product is distilled, must contain at least 51% corn. It also must be 160 proof or less and stored in charred new oak barrels at 125 proof or less, and it cannot contain any additives. Bourbon is intrinsically linked to Kentucky. In fact, 95% of the world's supply comes from the Bluegrass State. However, it isn't exclusively made there and can be produced anywhere in the United States. Federal standards governing the identity of bourbon, however, do dictate that it is a distinctive product of the United States and that the word bourbon shall not be used to describe any whiskey or whiskey-based distilled spirits not produced in the U.S. There are some specific rules to earning the title bourbon in your brand. Like any product category, there are value-based brands and high-end-based brands. But with bourbon, there is a huge spectrum. On the low end, brands like Earl Settler cost about $8 for a bottle, whereas a bottle of Blood Oath Packed Number 6 or the rare Pappy Van Winkle can go for thousands. Maker's Mark finds itself somewhere in between, averaging about $35 for a 750 milliliter bottle. Perhaps that's why it's been so popular, a middle of the road price point with a smooth, easy drinking finish. In early 2020, however, research reported the brand was slipping from the minds of millennials and could use a little upgrade. The challenge for Maker's Mark was to refresh the brand while not losing the essence of what makes it iconic. Could those responsible for the brand move it forward without regrets? For more backstory on Maker's Mark and what led up to their 2021 change of brand, let's go to brand strategist Tracy Clark for our briefing.
Neat, on the rocks, with Coke or in a cocktail. There's really no wrong way to enjoy Maker's Mark, and that's why the bourbon brand with the distinctive red wax seal has built a loyal following among whiskey snobs and regular Joes alike for nearly 70 years. In 1953, T. William Bill Samuel Sr. purchased the abandoned Burke's Distillery in Loretto, Kentucky. Bill, a sixth-generation distiller, was a descendant of the Samuels family that migrated to central Kentucky in the 1780s. With the purchase of the distillery, he now had the means to produce whiskey using his family's 170-year-old recipe. Unfortunately, shortly after his acquisition, Samuel set fire to the only copy of his family's recipe, as well as some of the house adjacent to the distillery. So he went back to the drawing board. Bill experimented with different mash variations, but he didn't have the time to distill, barrel, age, and then taste them years later. So he took a shortcut by baking 7 of his variations into 7 loaves of bread and used his friends and family as taste testers. This workaround not only saved Samuel's time, but also led him to use softer red winter wheat instead of the rye grain typically found in bourbon. The result yielded a mellow, sweeter taste instead of the distinctive burn that most whiskey drinkers are used to. You know the one. Margie Samuels, Bill's wife, collaborator, and co-founder of Maker's Mark, played a big role in making sure the family's bourbon was distinguished inside and out. The bottle shape, label design, and signature seal were all Margie's handiwork, not to mention the name itself. Maker's refers to the whiskey's handcrafted artisanal roots, and Mark nods to a subtle but important design element on the bottle label. Right next to the brand name, a star, the letter S, and the Roman numeral 4 are encircled. The S refers to the Samuels family name. The number 4 nods to Bill's lineage, although he later learned he was 6th generation, not 4th. And the star represents Star Hill Farm, where the family lived. Bill could have opted to name his bourbon after himself, but Margie insisted otherwise. She didn't want this more refined blend to be confused with T.W. Samuels, a wretched and god-awful whiskey, Margie's words, that had been in the family for more than a century. With bourbon and branding taken care of, Maker's Mark was ready for its debut. The distillery churned out its first production run in 1958, complete with the purely decorative yet iconic dripping wax seal, which, by the way, wasn't trademarked until 1985. When Maker's Mark debuted on the adult beverage scene, tastes were shifting. Post-prohibition era culture viewed bourbon as a downtrodden drink, and people were seeking something lighter, like vodka. In 1965, the Samuels family countered bourbon's perceived low status with a bold advertising campaign. It tastes expensive, and is. This slowly but surely created a shift in customer mindset and helped lead the charge of an American whiskey renaissance that is still going strong today. So it's safe to say these bold brand moves paid off. Over the decades, Maker's Mark racked up accolades and acquisitions. It was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1980, and a year later, it was sold to Hiram Walker & Sons. In turn, Allied Domecq acquired Hiram Walker and its assets in 1987. In 2005, Pernod Ricard purchased Allied Domecq, and Maker's Mark was then sold to Fortune Brands. In 2011, Fortune Brands split its alcohol business into Beam Incorporated, which became Beam Suntory in 2014. Okay, so that's a lot of business deals, but the Maker's Mark recipe has remained nearly unchanged. The distillery is generally known for its flagship blend, but over the years, Maker's Mark has added 5 iterations to the family over the years. Cask Strength, Maker's Mark 46, Private Selection, Maker's Mark 101, and Wood Finishing Series, as well as Seasonal Blend. You'll notice a moment ago that I said nearly unchanged. There was a bit of a snafu back in 2013 when the brand decided it would reduce the amount of alcohol. Yes, you heard that right, making it 84 proof instead of 90 proof in order to meet increasing global demand. To say customers were mad at this potential change is an understatement. They were mad. Rather than double down on the watering down, Maker's Mark issued a public apology and announced it would not change the original recipe after all. Acting fast and humbly allowed this beloved brand to learn from its mistake and continue to move forward. Bill Samuels Sr. remained at the helm until 1975 when he passed the leadership reins to his son and namesake, but he continued to play a vital role in production and operations until its first acquisition. Bill Jr. retired in 2011, and his son Rob took over as president and CEO of the distillery. Fast forward to present day, bourbon now accounts for about 37% share of the whiskey subcategory and 13% share of the total liquor category in 2021 to date. That data, coupled with a near legendary history, a family legacy, some bold brand moves that actually paid off, and most importantly, a surefire recipe. With all that said, why did Maker's Mark opt for a change of brand? Stay tuned for the full story.
The Maker's Mark brand identity has been around from the beginning. The serif logo feels strong, vintage, and Western, like it could have been branded into cattle owned by the Samuels family. It has remained virtually unchanged since the 50s. Similarly, the off-white bottle label with jagged torn edges and a dripping red wax seal for the bottle lid are iconic and jump off the shelves. The previous look and feel for the brand outside of the bottle or the packaging, however, just felt okay. Filled with darkly lit imagery and floods of black, it reminds me of a fancy steak restaurant or maybe a limited edition Garth Brooks album. It's not terrible, it just hasn't aged well. Interestingly, Jack Daniel's, its biggest brand rival, uses color, specifically black, in a very similar way. The updated visual identity that we're discussing today was led by Turner Duckworth. It's much brighter overall, swapping out the black char for a vintage off-white and floods of the signature red, more like the packaging. The Western type remains in place, and so does the logo. The biggest update for the refresh is an increased role by the red wax bottle seal. It's now a graphic element with embellished red drips forming the bottle shape. Campaigns, swag, and the overall identity feel more complete, and it's much more crafted. Handcrafted, in fact. Be sure to see the change of brand for yourself at achangeofbrand.com. To distill down the creative process, I spoke with Jared Britton, creative director with Turner Duckworth and one of the leads on this project. He grew up in New Zealand, where he also worked for a few years getting his feet wet in design. Around 2010, he made a move to London for work and found love meeting his wife, an American working abroad. Eventually, the pair decided to make the move to the West Coast in the U.S., and he got a job with Turner Duckworth. The design consultancy has been working with Beam Suntory, the parent brand, for years, and were brought in to extend the bourbon brand into the wider world. Not really a packaging refresh. Nonetheless, they were really excited about the opportunity to build on such a legacy brand. Jared, being a Kiwi and all, wasn't too keen on the American whiskey market, but he was coming around.
For me personally, you know, American whiskey is not that well known in New Zealand and the United Kingdom outside of Jack Daniel's. So it's not like I had a ton of like familiarity over the course of my life. I wasn't a whiskey drinker. But in the studio, we had worked on Old Overholt, which was a smaller rye brand. So we'd sort of started to dip our toes into that category. Obviously, we were working in spirits, so we knew enough. I think the main thing is, you know, we knew it was a much larger brand. It was much more famous than, you know, the tequila brands we've been working on. It was really sort of loved and respected internally. Everyone just kept on saying to us, you know, like, wait till you visit the distillery, wait till you go there, like, go see the farm. You are just going to like get what Maker's Mark is about. So there was a lot of excitement and sort of like focus on it. And, you know, mainly it felt like it was like a big opportunity within our Beam relationship. You know, it was like a step up in project.
What was the main problem they were looking to have you solve?
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing drastically wrong. You know, it's a very successful sort of brand and business. You know, when you ask people, you know, almost universally, they will say, yeah, I love Maker's Mark. But it was no longer like unaided. It was no longer necessarily top of mind. You know, Beam has, you know, big insights teams that have done a lot of brand tracking. And I think especially with younger audiences, they were sort of finding there was less and less resonance. Almost on one side, they had all of these like little craft independent brands nipping at their heels. On the other side, there were like these huge global powerhouses like Jack Daniel's and Johnny Walker, who I think in all fairness over the last decade or so had done a much better job of ingraining themselves in popular culture. So I think the exact wording of their brief was, you know, we want to build a global icon and we want to increase our relevance for the next generation of bourbon consumers. Fundamentally, that's marketing speak for, you know, we need to do better with millennials 25 to 35.
As Jared and his team began the work of evolving the Maker's Mark brand to be more relevant with millennials, they started to engage with a lot of stakeholders. packaging, trade, drink strategy, U.S., global, you name it. Most closely, they collaborated with Natalie Phillips, Senior Brand Director, and Jessica Spence, Head of Brands for Beam Suntory. They also collaborated with Rob Samuels, the grandson of the founders, Margie and Bill Samuels.
He is still the marketing director for Makers. He's still the general manager of the distillery. So, you know, having a family member involved was pretty interesting, especially because his grandmother, Margie Samuels, basically designed the look of the brand. She designed the red wax. She named it Maker's Mark. She designed their word mark, their label, everything. So, you know, we had someone who was obviously going to hold work up to the standard that she had set.
Normally, I would say this is a red flag. Rob is going to be the shot blocker of all creative ideas. Legacy brands already come with a resistance to change and often deep emotional connections. But knowing your grandmother literally designed the logo and bottle label, that's hard to overcome. Rob Samuels was the brand. It was in his DNA, and he knew it inside and out. However, Rob was making his own mark on the distillery world and was driving forward new initiatives around sustainability and innovation. So while he embodied the ethos of the brand, he also wanted it to change and to move forward. There were some pretty tight parameters on the project. They knew Maker's Mark had a great off-the-shelf recognition, and they didn't want to ruin that. The basic bottle design, again, had been in the market since 1954. So this wasn't a revolutionary change of brand. It was more subtle. And if type, layout, or other packaging elements were going to change, it was going to take one hell of a case. That didn't frighten Jared or the team, however. In fact, they found a way to roll with the punches.
One of our sort of insights was there were like these values that were being sort of represented in that original bottle that maybe had been lost in the wider brand world. So actually, more than anything, we did want it to be this sort of North Star that, you know, you hold the work up to. Does it feel like cohesive? So not really a limitation, but that was their guidance. And as you said, that meant, you know, not sort of reinventing word marks or like the general sort of vibe of the brand.
So tell us more about digging in to understand Maker's Mark and the ethos and getting to go visit the farm and the distillery. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so they wanted us to come in with fresh eyes and give a perspective, you know, on and sort of give like an overall direction for a creative idea. And so yeah, we there was three or four of us visited the distillery. It was everything that people said it was. You know, you drive for an hour and a half from Louisville into sort of the rolling hills of Kentucky. Remember, everyone told us to like stop off at this little gas station that does like the most amazing sausage sandwiches that you'll ever have. We did that, but yeah, you know, the buildings of the distillery are, you know, exactly what you picture in your mind when you think of like quintessential bourbon distillery. You know, there's a little stream running through the farm. They have forests with like this huge white oak repository where they do like a lot of studying of wood. It was just beautiful, really. So yeah, I mean, we went and visited there. We sort of visited the lake that there was their water source. And while there, we sort of had this information dump, and we got taken through like 70 years of brand history and founding, and like what the campaigns and the visual look of the brand had looked like over the, you know, the last few decades. And while there, we also did some stakeholder interviews with Rob and Jessica, just to make sure we understood what their like vision or job to be done was. I mean, it's crazy, their commitment to sort of like not changing that ethos. Like, as their sort of production has ramped up, rather than sort of like moving to bigger stills, they have actually like basically perfectly replicated the original stills. So they have like mirror images of this exact same still at the exact same size, because they are sort of worried that, or they want to make sure that like moving to a different production process will screw around with what the liquid tastes like. So they have like an amazing commitment to sort of like maintaining the way things have always been done, which is really, really nice. And you definitely just feel that as soon as you arrive.
once you met some of the people at the distillery and got a more true sense of the reality and the history, did you feel some pressure? Did you start to connect with some of the people that were your clients and think, oh, I really want to get this right. I really don't want to do this wrong. Like, did you start to feel more of the pressure?
I mean, definitely, but I guess I sort of feel that way at the start of any project, right? Like, you know, leading up to what we call the clarity brief phase and the first stage of creative, like there's always like a little bit of like nervousness and excitement that, you know, you want to please people and you want everyone to be on board. But yeah, I mean, the added pressure of, once again, having like a family member involved and, you know, that added a little bit to it. But yeah, there was definitely sort of nerves and pressure.
As Jared just mentioned, one of their first phases is a clarity brief. It's an effort to make sure everyone is headed in the right direction and aligned. But it's a beautiful hybrid of brand strategy and design exploration.
We do talk a lot about like the role of design in foundational strategy and how it's like very easy for strategists to come up with words on a page, but actually, like, are you ever going to be sure it's the exact right fit until you, I guess, stress test it or see a little bit of like design work laddering up to that idea? So at the alignment brief phase, clarity brief, you know, I think we were still toying with like characterful or something as the word, but the main thing is, you know, we had definitely defined that like the brand needed to better represent some of the original values it was founded on, some of the values we saw at the distillery, including this like amazing commitment of still doing a lot of stuff like the right way, still doing a lot of stuff by hand. I mean, they hand cut their labels on this like antique manual wrought iron machine. They hand rotate their barrels. People are always surprised to find out that like they still hand dip every single bottle in wax. So yeah, there was this sort of like vibe and ethos that was coming through. And the main insight was like, this needs to be represented in the work.
The fact that Maker's Mark still hand dips their wax seals is absurd to me in a good way. I've shopped the bourbon aisle a time or two, and I would have bet a round of drinks that it was machine fabricated with some feature to make it look hand dipped. While other brands in the category have found ways to use more cheaply produced wax seals, Maker's Mark is committed to deliberate inefficiency for the sake of the brand.
There is this general sort of commitment to like, if we give an inch, we'll lose a mile. And it's, you know, we're a successful brand. Like, yeah, we could save a little bit of money by automating this process, but like, would we be losing something about who we are as a brand? So there's like this, you know, there's this idea of almost deliberate inefficiency running through what they do in a lot of areas, but it feels like everyone has like fully bought into this idea of like doing things what they consider to be the, like the right way.
Knowing the ethos of Maker's Mark was all about craft, they quickly started to make some decisions about the visual language.
I guess from executional perspective, there were some pretty obvious moves to make. You know, things like color approach. Like, we knew that consumers saw us as a red and cream brand. Like, why weren't they our brand colors at the time they were using black? There, in general, with, you know, heritage brands, there's that great quote by like I think the CEO of Aston Martin, where he said, you know, legacy is history with a future. And I guess when you work on these brands that have a history, you always want to like dip into, you know, any latent equities they have, or, you know, typefaces or colors or sort of things that had existed in their past that you can potentially like use and bring into the future. So from a tactical and executional perspective, you know, the team just started like ideating on broad moves that would sort of achieve what we wanted to do. But funnily enough, this wasn't a project that felt like there were different conceptual options or ways in. For example, on colors, I don't think that we wanted to pose the question, you know, do you want to be red and cream? Here's an option for that. It was more like, you are a red and cream brand, whether we all like it or not. And actually, what we need to do is work out how to use those colors. You know, here's a bunch of different work and activations that use those colors in different ways. What's resonating, what feels right, and then we can sort of refine and iterate from there.
While the team was working on the first round of design, Jared was called into a meeting in Chicago. The Beam Suntory team was there working on some strategy for Jim Beam, Maker's lower-end cousin, and a brand that a mere whiff of still reminds me of college. While Jared was there, he had a discussion with Jessica Spence and the brand team to really go all in on the handmade elements for the Maker's Mark brand. All of the pieces were falling into place. They knew the vibe, they wanted something iconic, and they wanted it to resonate with a millennial audience. This, however, was around March 2020. And like many projects around this time, the buzz was about to wear off.
We'd obviously been talking about COVID and stuff, but it got really real when I got back. And it's relevant because obviously we had to pivot to a Zoom presentation, which we would not normally do for first stages of work like this. It means there wasn't a room to read. You don't get those sort of slightly boozy dinners and drinks afterwards where you get like a real sense of how people are feeling. So I do remember presenting the work and, you know, the document, the thinking was great, but probably even for the client, responding to a remote design presentation was new, and there was just sort of silence at the end.
Okay, when we come back from the break, we get the rest of the rebrand story and find out if Jared and his team quickly get over their remote presentation hangover. All that and more after the break.
Hey, listeners. If the brand nerd in you is digging our podcast, we've got good news for you. Blake, the host of this show, wrote a book. It's called Radically Relevant, and it's full of insights and tips for CMOs and other brand leaders that are ready to get their brand unstuck and leveled up. There's also a pretty cool assessment tool to see just how radically relevant your brand is. The book officially launches this fall, but you can take the Radically Relevant assessment today for free and buy the book on presale. Just go to radicallyrelevantbrand.com. We'll also link it in today's show notes. Last but not least, don't forget to join in on the conversation on Instagram. See more about today's episode, share with a friend, or send us an idea for a future episode at A Change of Brand. All right, back to the show.
Responding to a remote design presentation was new, and there was just sort of silence at the end. And we tried to like tease out responses and start sort of discussion. Everyone said they were happy, but it was, there just wasn't much chatter at all. And, you know, we did do a sort of internal Slack call directly after, and we were trying to be positive, but there was definitely this sort of uneasy, like, I think this went well, but I'm not really sure. You probably have to ask the clients what they were thinking when they first saw the work.
The lack of small talk before the meeting and after the meeting is really where you get a sense of, okay, I think that really went well, or okay, we've got a few things we need to keep working on. And without that, you really do feel like you're in a vacuum. Okay, so you had that Zoom presentation right when, you know, the early stages of the pandemic were starting. How did you and the team sort of regroup or progress from there?
Yeah, so we got sort of consolidated feedback a couple of weeks later, and you know, the good news was they did love the work. It really was just a case of individual clients not wanting to sort of commit to anything on the spot before they had aligned and regrouped internally. Obviously that we all breathed a sigh of relief because, as mentioned, we'd only sort of presented one broad direction in. What we had done was sort of like, in that first stage, was written a more sort of formalized manifesto around handmade. We had outlined like three creative principles that we sort of felt to us with fresh eyes encapsulated what the brand stood for, and all the work had been presented underneath those brand behaviors, which I think was really helpful, not only for us as designers, right? Like, we can very quickly get caught up in whether something looks good or not, you know, really in the weeds, but actually having to explain why each piece of design ladders up to one of these behaviors not only helped us, but I think from a client perspective, it sort of aided them in how to feedback, right? Because was it particular activations that were not resonating, or was it more we're unsure of this brand behavior and do we need to sort of like noodle around the exact wording of these things? Because once you get those right, design sort of falls relatively easily.
Okay, from here, Turner Duckworth kept ironing out those brand principles and design tactics. They landed on three phrases to sum up the visual identity system: simple confidence, carefully crafted, and perfectly flawed. These words are super helpful to carve out the ethos of the brand, which isn't exactly modern or sleek. There's no confusing Maker's Mark for some uber fancy Norwegian whiskey brand, which is actually a thing.
Someone had obviously over time tried to like dial up the jankiness a little bit. Like actually where the logo was like much more visually messy than what Margie had originally designed. And I don't know whether it was just like over a period of years, you know, scanning the mark in and recreating it and stuff. But, you know, yeah, for all intents and purposes, it was visually basically the same. You know, we did a little bit of refinement to it, just like tightening things up, but yeah, largely unchanged.
So far, things are going down fairly smooth, besides the global pandemic, of course, which we already covered. But I know how these projects can go. Surely there's something a little spicy with the kick, right?
Yeah. So I think the two main discussion points through the process were the color approach to start off with. And then also we had introduced a new graphic icon. So on the colors, especially in markets outside the US, there was just this general concern that like red is not premium, red is not a bourbon color. And, you know, that view is probably why they were using black in the, as their current sort of identity. You know, people feel comfortable when you do things that look like the rest of the category. And we really wanted to sort of stay strong on this. You know, I think as a general branding principle, right? Like you don't want to behave like everyone else. You want to behave like yourself. And we sort of really kept on trying to sort of push the point that we're not trying to look like bourbon. We're trying to look like Maker's Mark. And, you know, obviously, we totally get that red in many instances can be cheap, but I think there's also a ton of brands out there like Christian Louboutin uses red, Ferrari uses red, Beats uses red. So, you know, it's more about how you use it. Most importantly, it was a unique color to us. And I think it was more just over the course of the project, showing them how red could be used in a way that felt, you know, crafted and handmade and sort of appropriately premium for where we sat. On the icon, you know, they had heard previously, obviously with different executions, but when their wax was represented graphically away from the bottle, it could look like ketchup or blood, you know, which once again, it makes total sense. It just meant we, you know, from an executional standpoint, we did explore like the characteristics of the drips, like how thin the liquid was versus how gloopy it felt. We looked at like how much of the bottle shape needed to be defined. You know, like in reality, the wax only sits on the neck, but it was sort of graphic and abstract enough that through exploration, we realized that we could define the shape of the shoulders. You could get a sense that it was a bottle and it still felt, you know, connected to reality. But also, you know, from a more strategic perspective, I think most people just didn't think consumers would get it, especially outside the US. I don't think they thought Maker's was that recognizable. And for a few stages after that first round presentation of the icon, it was actually just a ton of like writing rules around the icon, making sure, you know, there was, you know, make sure there's context through messaging, make sure there are other identifiable assets in the activation, stuff like that, almost not undermining it, but like, I guess, surrounding the icon with so many other contextual cues that like no one would ever be mistaken that this is a mark for Maker's.
Because I've never put two and two together, but the actual wax on the bottle stops on the neck, but then the graphic icon goes over the shoulders. So I just love that. Like the graphic icon, it just reminds you of the bottle. It doesn't depict exactly what's happening on the bottle, but your brain fills in the gaps and makes the connection.
Yeah, and I think also like speaking to the fact that these are all hand dipped, like that idea of every wax dip is unique. So sometimes there are instances where it does go further down the bottle, and you know, and there are also instances like on cask strength where they do over dip it, like one in every 10 bottles over the shoulders. So it felt like it was bringing that uniqueness to life as well. And actually, there are we ended up designing four icons to be used completely interchangeably. And I guess the idea was, you know, if you do use sort of mix and match these things, you're almost creating one mark, but the sense that this mark is ever changing and slightly different, just like the actual wax.
The language in complement to the visuals is really important to present an identity that feels cohesive. And there were some really great lines like character isn't made by machines, or handmade whiskey, hand dipped bottles. Tell us more about the brand voice and the way you all maybe thought about how language should play a part with the identity for Maker's Mark.
So the tone wasn't really up for grabs, and they had used character isn't made by machine in a previous campaign, and we sort of built off that. So yeah, handmade whiskey, hand-dipped bottle, there was this line, Bill made it bourbon, Margie made it iconic. We were just sort of looking for like neat little captures of brand truths. And they all had to feel relatively evergreen, because once again, like we weren't designing a campaign, there wasn't a comm strategy to go with it. It was more just, these are brand fundamentals, and you know, more than anything, sort of directional in tone for how the brand should behave moving forward.
That's great. So in general, you know, as you look back on the work, what do you think was really special about where you landed? Or like, why did you personally feel confident moving through, you know, different presentations or rounds of the work that it was the right direction?
I think what's special about the work for me is that I think it all feels really obvious, despite the change actually being quite drastic. And we sort of heard this in testing as well. You know, people just said, yeah, this new direction feels more like Makers. And I guess for a 70-year-old brand, that's a pretty big compliment. But yeah, it didn't feel like there was some genius creative unlock going on. It was, there's just this broad sense of like, of course, this is what Maker's Mark should look like.
As the work was nearing completion, they moved into a testing phase to see how well the wax drip icon, color strategy, and other elements would work across six different countries. And ultimately, they wanted to know if they nailed it or really created something that would resonate with those wild millennials.
Honestly, it was probably the most one-way research that I've ever been involved in, which sort of touches on what I was just saying before about it feeling right. Like, controversy is not the right word. It's almost the opposite of that. But actually, the biggest change coming out of research was we basically got to like strip out a ton of those contextual requirements and rules and guidance around the icon and other assets that the markets had been wanting. Like, there were literally like dudes in Russia who weren't even current drinkers of the brand looking at like the icon and saying, oh yeah, that's like that American whiskey brand with red wax or something like that. So it definitely was really successful research. And after that, it was sort of full steam ahead.
That's such a rare story. Usually research ruins everything. Yeah, from exactly. A visual perspective, usually you're like, oh gosh, we have to research. After the testing phase, they moved into aligning and socializing the new brand language with internal resources at Beam Suntory and other outside agencies, just to make sure the ethos and vision would translate well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, so we deliver the brand guidelines, and we always factor in, like, you know, there should be ongoing stewardship. And there was what they called like a roadshow where we encapsulated, like, this is what we were trying to achieve with this refresh, and like really tried to sort of take internal teams and the creative agencies through more like what we were trying to achieve and why, rather than being overly prescriptive.
As you, dear listener, know, going public with the brand work is always fun. In this case, however, there's nothing really grand to report. In January 2021, the new identity started to roll out to various agencies and materials started to sneak into various markets. Brand New picked up the story later in May when Turner Duckworth published their work. And in some ways, I wish there were protests in Loretto, Kentucky, over how offensive the use of red was, or bar fights or turf wars ignited between rival Kentucky brands like Knob Creek or Old Crow. But at the end of the day, the work just made sense for the brand and people liked it. Maybe because it was a refinement overall, or maybe because the old visual system outside of the bottle was, as Jeremy W. commented on Brand New, a quote, snooze fest. The only real drama point was the dynamic between the corporate group Beam Suntory, who Jared was working primarily with through the project, and local markets, which is where the general consumer engages with the brand communications. Think of the end cap display of Maker's Mark at your local ABC liquor store. There was a bit of a disconnect there.
A lot of creative work came back that felt like very sort of rigid and overly tight. Like people were just sort of slavishly taking something that we had designed and just sort of like repeating that thing everywhere with different messages attached to it. So you had, you know, these good creative partners and they were already potentially feeling constrained. So I guess sort of like what happened with the icon, in the end, we got to sort of like open it up again, sort of towards, you know, as we were writing guidelines and almost like the last stage of work, and really sort of shifted focus to helping teams understand why you may want to use assets and what that would communicate, rather than prescribing, you know, headline goes here, bottle goes here, choose your color background sort of thing.
This is a theme I'm seeing time and time again, either with stories on this show or in my own work. The objective of brand guidelines is not restraint, but rather inspiration. For a long time, guidelines have been treated like a manifesto written by the brand police, equipping CDs to get slap happy with logo misuse fines. But for large teams looking to have a lively and relevant brand in the market, you need to capture the spirit of the brand and then empower teams to create out of that ethos. Guidelines have become the place for inspiration, not limitation. Much like a good bourbon, time will tell whether the Maker's Mark icon will be indeed iconic. Overall, I think there are a few good lessons here. If you are leading or contributing to a rebrand, make sure you get really clear on the objective. In this case, it wasn't about a rebrand. It was about connecting with a new demographic and remaining relevant for generations to come. Secondly, it's important to consider the existing equity and affinity for the brand. Dumping out the recognition of the Maker's Mark bottle for the sake of a new, more modern brand identity might have looked good on a Behance portfolio, but it would have been disaster on the shelves and for the business. They did right by letting the packaging design influence the wider brand communications. It seems the rebrand came at a surprisingly great time. Even though COVID threw a wrench in the creative process, it seems people were very thirsty during the pandemic. Revenue reports aren't easy to find for Maker's Mark since it's one of many brands among the Beam Suntory organization, so I can't find earnings reports for the brand. However, in 2021, Maker's Mark did move from third to second place for top-selling bourbons in the U.S., As for Jared, he's excited to see what's to come for the brand.
Obviously, I think it's been massively worth it because they now have like foundations to build off. You know, we have outlined this sort of fundamental, this is how makers should look and behave in order to feel like makers. And I guess the exciting part is now what they're going to do next. Like a brand like Nike, you know, is it a global icon because they have a graphic swoosh mark, or is it because of how they've used that graphic swoosh, you know, the cultural meaning that they've imbued into it, the campaigns, the communication surrounding it, like over the course of decades, really. So you do need those foundations and to do that sort of stuff. And I think Makers has that now. And, you know, we are still working with them. I think the stuff they're going to be doing this year is more exciting than what they did last year. And the stuff that they're going to do in 2023 is even more exciting than that. So yeah, we've sort of like laid the platform, and I think it's like the start of some pretty interesting stuff to come. But my dad did send me a text the other day from New Zealand, and like his local liquor store had like four posters of Maker's Mark on their outside wall, including a couple with the new icon. So I don't know. I guess if New Zealand's getting it and understanding it, then it bodes relatively well for the global rollout.
That's amazing. I love that. Does your dad know what you do? Can he explain what you do?
I think he could probably explain what I do. He'll definitely be a listener of this podcast when it comes out. Maybe that'll help him.
Yeah. The big question is, are you now a American whiskey Maker's Mark fan? Has this project converted you from your New Zealand, you know, alcohol of choice to now good old fashioned backwoods of Kentucky whiskey?
It has. I mean, even when I first moved from the UK, you know, where gin is really big, you know, I moved here, started working on tequila brands and got really into those. And, you know, all my friends back home, you know, tequila, I wouldn't drink that. So I became a tequila connoisseur. And, you know, now I've definitely been getting into bourbon and rye as well. So I guess my palate is expanding.
Okay, that is a wrap. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Jared Britton for his take on the project, and Jessica Rogers at Turner Duckworth for responding to my email and supporting the show. To see more visuals from today's episode, head on over to achangeofbrand.com. And if you liked today's show, please share it with a friend or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Today's episode was edited by Gabe Kitzman, fact-checked by Jill Jeffries, written in part by Pamela Hinman, and produced by Patrice Fielder. Special thanks to Tracy Clark for the brief in and Rachel Jackson for today's artwork. I'm your host, Blake Howard, signing off.